a lot of the concerns that people have now around interacting with machine learning systems is, this is creepy. I don't know how it's using my data. I don't know why it's using my data. And it makes me feel uncomfortable. Everything's listening to me, or I can't escape. Or even the complete opposite is, I've given up. There's no such thing as privacy. You have data that you wrote. You have a purpose that you want to use for it. It should be that you own your data, that you're able to choose how your data is used. I think the whole movement now to individualize your own models or to personalize your own models is a really good example of people saying, you know what? Why should OpenAI have all the fun with my data? I want to use my data and I want to build my own models for myself. And I think that's a really strong example of real data ownership and real consent and real ability to use your own data for powerful things that you want to do.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Ken's Nearest Neighbors, the podcast where I bring in fascinating people from my world, talk about life, data science, sports analytics, content creation, and much, much more. I'm your host, Ken G. If you haven't already, we'd greatly appreciate it if you gave us a rating and followed the show. It helps us to continue to bring in incredible guests. This episode of Ken's Nearest Neighbors is powered by Z by HP, HP's high compute workstation grade line of products and solutions. Today, I had the pleasure of interviewing Catherine Jarmel. Catherine recently published Practical Data Privacy, a book that's extremely relevant with the fast expansion of LLMs and other AI products. In this episode, we touch on her experience as a data journalist, how she thinks companies are handling data privacy with the expansion of all these new AI tools, and how someone can prepare themselves for a career in the data privacy space. Catherine was amazing to talk to, and I'm sure you'll enjoy our conversation. So Catherine, thank you so much for coming on the Ken's Nearest Neighbors podcast. Obviously, you just released your new book on data privacy. We've talked a little bit about your history in data journalism, and I think this is all shaping up to be a really interesting episode on a domain that I haven't really talked about or learned about that much. So I'm very excited to dive in here.
Yeah, I'm really excited. Thanks again for inviting me.
Of course, of course. Well, so one thing we do to get everyone a bit more familiar with you is, I'd love to hear a story about how you first got interested in data. So was this a pivotal moment? Did something happen and say, hey, this domain's really interesting? Or has it been more of a slow progression over time?
I think that it's probably always been interesting. I was a bit of a kid that was into math and so forth. But I think the first time that I really think I worked on data and I saw its powers was doing my thesis in university, in which I studied embedded and non-embedded war reporting in the war in Iraq. And I did a statistical analysis of sourcing and so forth. And I actually found an outlier. And in finding that outlier and then doing some qualitative interviews, that outlier was the only one who was a native Arabic speaker. And so it was kind of cool to see that you could literally use data to teach you that there was a story to be found somewhere in that data. And then, you know, getting to interview the journalist who was a multiple Pulitzer Prize winning journalist who unfortunately passed away an asthma attack a few years ago, Anthony Shadid, but was just really powerful. And all that happened in my undergraduate study. And I think that made me fall more in love with data and decide, okay, this is really something I want to do.
So, I mean, that is an incredible and fascinating first intro to data. I mean, I think that we're constantly now bombarded with data in the news, you know, statistics and these types of things, not necessarily always representative. I think a lot of people realize that depending on how, I forget what the quote is, but basically you can tell any story with statistics depending on how you cut it. There's some significantly more elegant way that people have described that. But I'm interested, how did you follow up on that? You know, did you continue going down that road associated with using data in storytelling? Or was that just a sort of one-off sidebar there?
Yeah, so after I graduated, this was back in a time where we didn't have that many available jobs in data that weren't something like database management or database administration. It was quite some time ago. And I was really motivated to do something that I thought would empower the world. And so the first thing I actually did is I became a school teacher. And I was a high school teacher in New York, in a school that had significant amount of free lunch. It was definitely the students there. It was an automotive school, and the students there were very much underserved by the education system. And there I got to see kind of up close hand what happens when we don't invest in education and so forth. And that eventually led me down a path to go get my degree in journalism. And so first I went and got my degree in journalism. And at the time we had an area of journalism called computational journalism, which today we would call data journalism. And I really ended up growing into that and ended up then thereafter working at the Washington Post.
That's amazing. And would you be able to describe data journalism? It seems pretty straightforward, but I feel like there's a little bit more nuance to what that is if there's a whole domain associated with it. Because this isn't something that I realized was taught in journalism school at all.
Yeah. And I think depending on your journalism school, your results might vary. And I imagine it's changed a lot since when I went to school, even J school. But the idea of data journalism is not disparate from the idea of using the statistical reasoning or data reasoning we would use as data scientists, let's say, and applying it to investigate a story or investigate, is there something here? And so as you can imagine, at a place like the Washington Post, there's several different investigative teams that need data to back up the things that they're looking at. Sometimes they have a source come to them, and a source has a bunch of data. And a lot of times journalists are not exactly trained in statistics or trained in math even. And so it's kind of something that the ones that are better at it end up usually assisting those teams in figuring out, okay, how do we want to tell this story? Is there something to be told here with the data? If so, how do we want to visualize it? How do we want to story tell? So it kind of errs on the side of exploratory analysis and then looking at visualizations and interactives and figuring out how to help other people who might not have a history or background in data understand the story.
That sounds eerily close to data science.
Right.
to me, that's really eye-opening. I didn't realize that there was this essentially subdomain of journalism that really focuses on that. But now that you describe it, it seems like a lot of the work across quite a few domains is exactly that. I mean, I work in sports. My main work is in performance. But most of the analytics that are being done in that domain, I would argue, is to improve the fan experience, to tell different stories about what the players are doing or why things are happening, and to enhance or to understand the stories that are being played out in that domain. And it's not obviously not as serious as most of the data journalism that's probably more hard-hitting that you were focusing on, but it's still the same, like meat and bones underneath the infrastructure. And one of my favorite YouTubers, this guy CoffeeZilla, so he essentially finds fraudsters on the internet and follows the blockchain and analyzes to understand, okay, why is this person having success as a fraud? Let's out them and make sure people aren't getting scammed. And he uses quite a bit of this same approach, and he's essentially an investigative journalist that, to me, one of the best storytellers, as well as data people. And what I love about this domain is that you can bring in those case studies. You can enhance the story with individuals telling their stories. You can pull these case studies out and integrate it with the data work in a way that I guess we can do as data scientists, but it's just definitely doesn't feel as compelling when I do that, right? It's kind of hard.
But like, I mean, there's also some really cool sports journalism that's very data-based. Like, I remember 538, I think, and I don't know if you know Nate Silver's 538, but when they first started, they did also some really interesting analysis of, like, where penalties are called in football games and where most basketballs are hit from three-pointer lines, and these types of aggregate statistics of looking at performance and strategy of a game via the data, and maybe even looking at how some players perform differently than others, like the outliers, so forth, or some teams have different strategies than others. And I think that could be really fun, especially for sports fans to take a look and investigate how does your team play, and all the data is there. Like, that's the best thing about sports, is there's so much data and most of it is published online. So you can actually really get quite a bit of data without trying too hard.
Yeah, well, I have to imagine 538 has essentially made a career out of data journalism. I mean, mm-hmm. they obviously do sports, but they also, I believe they do the election predictions. Mm-hmm. They have a very interesting and engaging analysis of that. At least for U.S. elections, it's not as relevant to you anymore. But there's a ton of really interesting stuff, and you just completely turn on a light bulb in my head to realize that that is probably the news or the types of articles that I'm most compelled towards.
Aha! Yes, because you like storytelling with data, I imagine.
I mean, I have to. I guess in theory, a reasonable amount of what I do is sort of in the same domain. It's not that I'm telling stories with the data. I'm telling stories about the data and about the domain. So, you know, I think I have a long way to go as a aspiring data journalist. But
strong but start.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I'd love to learn about how you moved into maybe more traditional data roles after pursuing data journalism and what sort of the output was there, because I'm very interested in what maybe a more traditional data scientist could learn from someone with these data journalism skills.
Yeah. So after I left the Washington Post, I helped lead another news team at USA Today, and we did some pretty amazing interactives. So we did an interactive 10 years after Katrina that won a bunch of awards, that looking at how the neighborhoods had changed and doing quite a bit of demographic research, but also doing some NLP. So some studies of kind of alluring back to my thesis, which was basically NLP encoding and determining who is the statistical outlier via that. And so I got reached out to, or a team reached out from LA who was working on NLP in the news space. And they were trying to identify trends. They were trying to identify hot topics and so forth. And this was back in 2009, 2010, when that was still, it was pre all the machine learning that we have now to do those things. And the team was really compelling with some ex-Googlers and ex-Yahoo folks. So I took the dive and I went and joined a startup and moved back to LA, which is where I grew up. And that was really fun. And that was my first, I would say, big data role and first NLP role. And there was also a lot of other things to learn about startup life and learning how to navigate in a startup. And that was a lot of fun. So that was, I guess, my transition. And I had the luck of being there at the right time, of being there like right when NLP was starting to kick off again. And that was, yeah, just a good time to be involved in data.
What was the biggest shock moving from journalism to, I guess, startup life technically?
Yeah, I think so. In journalism, we're used to working like ragged hours and, you know, the final push before you get a big thing out, especially, you know, a disaster happens or something happens and then it's all hands on deck. Everybody comes in and helps out. So that was kind of, I was used to that. But what I wasn't used to is there was no end to it. like, you know, and journalism is like, oh, the big story's out. Okay, now we can all rest for a few days. But it felt like startups, at least a few of the startups I was involved in when I first went back to LA, were just kind of everybody going full bore all the time. And that was a lot. I mean, I was much younger then, so I could kind of keep up, but it was a lot. And I think I didn't also realize, like, there was no hierarchy of decisions a lot of times. It was kind of like, what's the best idea? Let's discuss it and then we'll just go. And in a newsroom, there's always an editor. You know, there's always somebody that has a vision and they're probably going to say yes or no. Of course, they take input from the team, but it was interesting for me to start to learn how does collaborative decision-making at a startup look. And some startups are different than others. You know, some have a really strong CEO that wants to have it exactly a certain way, and others are more of this team-building type. And that was interesting to learn for me, at least. I don't know if that was how your experience has been with leadership decisions.
No, I think from talking to a lot of people and sort of blending my own experiences in, very, very similar to that, in the sense that the way, let's say, media more traditionally is very consistently structured in that way. I mean, some maybe newer age media companies give bloggers a lot of freedom and let them do what they want, but I think that that's relatively non-traditional. And most startups are a little bit more freeform, but it does operate on a spectrum for sure. Yeah. And depending on what team you go into, you can get a very different experience from one to another. And I think that that variability is what makes startups particularly interesting, because newsrooms are usually, I would imagine, relatively established. All startups are essentially starting from the ground up. It's in the name. unless they had previously done another company and are doing this after. And part of being in a startup is the company finding its identity, finding what works well for its workflow. And I don't think that that's something that in more structured organizations you really think about a whole lot. I think half the battle of a startup is, hey, we're building this, we're trying to create something great, but in the process, we're also trying to figure out who we are and how we operate and what works best for us as we scale. And that can be really exciting. It can also be very frustrating at the same time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it's like a really great experience if you're early on in your career to kind of be a part of these early formations of a team. And figuring out, you know, what role do you want to play? What role would you rather not play? I think going through a lot of those iterations early on in your career can be really helpful to figure out, this is the type of leader I am. This is how I like to make decisions. These are the way I like to learn from people. And I think that I really benefited from doing that so early on, which was nice.
I'd like to take a quick second to thank one of our sponsors, Pathrise. Job hunting can be daunting, particularly in today's unpredictable world. Pathrise matches you with a dedicated mentor in your field to provide tailored support throughout your job search journey. From optimizing your resume and application process to mastering your interview skills, their expert guidance prepares you to secure your dream job and to negotiate a competitive salary. The cherry on top is that you don't pay until you secure that high-paying job that you've been aiming for. Don't hesitate. Visit pathrise.com/KenG to get matched with an expert mentor today. This episode of Ken's Nearest Neighbors is brought to you by Z by HP, HP's high-compute, workstation-grade ladder products and solutions. Z is specifically made for high-performance data science solutions, and I personally use the ZBook Studio and the Z8 workstation. I really love that the Z workstations can come standard with Linux or WSL2, and they can be configured with the Data Science Software Stack Manager. With the Software Stack Manager, you can get right to the work of doing data science on day one without the overhead of having to completely reconfigure your new machine. Now back to our show.
Amazing. Well, so something I'm pretty interested in is, how did you develop the technical skills during this process? Is that something that was taught in data journalism, or are those things, particularly NLP, things you picked up on your own to be able to apply them?
Yeah, it's a great question. In data journalism, I think the only thing that I learned is they taught us Flash. Do you remember Flash?
Yeah, it has been retired.
Yeah, Adobe he got retired at some point in time. Yeah. Anyways, but the good thing was is I had done statistical reasoning with language as part of my undergraduate thesis, and I was a little bit familiar with how do we encode language into data. Of course, it's different now, so we didn't have the concept of embeddings. We didn't have any of the stuff that we have now in NLP, but we still had ways to encode language into computational space of some sort, and then to run analysis on it. And so when I joined the NLP company, and it had some Zooglers and some ex-Yahoo folks, so it also had folks that were familiar at that point in time with how those companies were doing data processing. And at that point in time, we were still kind of calling it data mining. And it was around the time Hadoop was first open source and so forth. And so it was still this idea of, you know, bag of words, TF-IDF, you know, document similarity, these types of things, but named entity recognition. But the fundamental theories of a lot of those things haven't changed. We've just changed the way that we actually process the data. So the encoding is a lot more similar now, and the algorithms are more complicated. And so I think it was just an opportune time because it was the first beginning of us running large-scale distributed compute. Even as a startup, you could do that. And I think that that was a really great time to just dive back into it. Then how did I learn? I mean, I've always been good at math. I think I continued being curious about math. And I like to try to say to folks, the field of data science, it didn't exist when I went to school, but I still was able to learn it and do it. And I think I want to encourage people who don't have traditional data science backgrounds to say, okay, I can read through this, I can reason about it, I can bring whatever skill set or strengths that I have, and I can help boost my own self-learning through the process. And I think for me, that's also how I learned deep learning and all of the other stuff is through self-study and, you know, taking part in courses and so forth, but mainly self-study, reading books, working through the math, reading papers, and being curious about it, experimenting with it as deep learning became a real thing in NLP around whatever, 2012, 2013.
I don't think we could be more aligned on what you just said there. I completely agree. And I really like what you said about curiosity, that you were curious about it. I think that that is the biggest barrier that people need to, well, not the biggest barrier, the thing that people need to be mindful of the most is that when you approach a domain, let's say deep learning, it seems very complicated. And in some sense, it is very complicated. But the more you learn, the more knowledge you accumulate, the less complicated it is. If you understand one concept, that means you'll probably understand the next concept better. And mm-hmm. So you have this really steep learning curve to get to this critical mass of knowledge. And then once you reach that, everything else becomes relatively more easy because you've built up a body of knowledge to be able to reference. And I think a lot of people, when they transfer in or they try to pick up this domain, they're focused so much on the things they don't understand that they get overwhelmed. When if they rely on the things that are familiar to them, they can pick it up way easier. And I just couldn't agree more about sort of playing to your strengths and entering in there and then sort of branching out through that.
Yeah. And that's why some of the people that I sponsor, I've told, I don't know if you've heard of this idea, but to keep a log of all the things, the times that you get stuck, And to literally write, like, I'm stuck, like, this is what I can't understand, whether you're debugging something or whether you're trying to work through a textbook or something, and then look back on it a month or two later, because, and write down too when you figure it out or when you get unstuck. And I think that people don't realize that they're learning so much because the field is so massive. That they're always being confronted with things they don't know, but what they're not taking the time to do is appreciate what they already do know or have learned. And I think it can be really useful even just to reward yourself and be kind to yourself. Hey, look at all this stuff I knew. A year ago, I didn't know what nearest neighbors was as an algorithm, and now I do. Or a year ago, I had no idea what cluster compute was, and now I do. And so I think there's so much that you can be kind to yourself while you're learning, especially such a field like data science, which is way too big.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny. One of my favorite things that I've done, I haven't done it as much recently, is I started this 66 Days of Data initiative. So essentially, for 66 days straight, and 66 days is the average amount of time that it takes to ingrain a new habit. Obviously, a problem with averages, but that's where the 66 came from. Okay. But essentially, every day you spend at least 5 minutes learning, and every day you post about it somewhere, whether it's in the Discord server, whether it's on Twitter, whether it's on LinkedIn, whatever it might be. We have people going for 500, 600 days now, which is really cool.
Nice.
But the coolest thing is that they're building a catalog of all the things that they've learned, and they can go back to their early days. They go back through all 66 days or whatever it might be and see how far they've come and see the momentum they've created. So we're, again, complete kind of mind meld on that front.
That's really great. Yeah, no, I mean, I think we don't celebrate the wins sometimes enough when we're just starting out in a new thing and it feels a little bit daunting. That's really awesome. That sounds like a very cool project.
Yeah, well, there's also the accountability factor is if, hey, I'm going to be sharing this in a community, other people can encourage you, other people can give you feedback. And there's just so many cool things. I really should do another session. I was trying to do two a year, but life got in the way. And that's not a good excuse for me. I need to be a little bit better on that front. Before we leave the media topic, I want to make sure we definitely touch on data privacy in a little bit. But there's been a lot of change in the media landscape recently. I think large language models make it very easy to produce reasonably high quality content at massive volume. Mm-hmm. So maybe not, obviously not the best quality of content, mm-hmm. but I've been fooled by what is written by ChatGPT and what has been written by a human before. Let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering what your perspective is on how data and innovation in AI is changing the media landscape, and if it's a bad thing or a good thing.
I mean, I tend to stray away from bad, good labels on totally technology, fair. but even when I was active in journalism, which now has been some time, mind you, there was still at that point in time called robo reporting. And it would often be for like local papers and so forth. They would have a robo report write up things like the results of a sports team game. And it would be taken from a little pieces of data, and then it would be put through essentially a program that could write an article out of it. It was no machine learning, let's just be very clear, but it was still a computer writing an article given a few pieces of data. And we also had that for elections. So oftentimes for like the little small elections, the city, you know, council, those would all be robocopy, if you will. So it's not exactly very new, the idea that computers will assist in articles, at least in a certain realm of that. But what we do know is the large language model cannot know what will happen in the future, and it cannot write what will happen in the future. And should there be, let's say, another global pandemic, it will not know how that will happen. So I think there will always be news reporting. What I think it might create is a lot more of these content farms. And I don't know, I was in the Los Angeles tech scene when Calacanis had Mahalo running. And I don't know if anybody knows what Mahalo is, but if you're listening and you know what Mahalo is, you might know where I'm going with this. It was basically like an SEO, SEM farm thing where you just try to put as much content that you think will attract clicks on a page. And you know, you accidentally sometimes click on those, a link like, oh, I want to read that. And then you end up and you're like, where am I? Yeah, exactly. You're like, what part of the internet am I on? Run away, run away. I think LLMs and even multimodal models, so ones that can produce video, let's say, or audio, I think those are going to end up creating a whole bunch of this type of essentially very low quality content that's out there, but it's just generic enough or just like clickbaity enough that people will click it. And they might not even realize, like you said, they might not realize that a human didn't write it, but it just has this very generic, you know, when you're on an article like that and it's like five. I mean, Yahoo News is, no offense, Yahoo News, if you're listening, but Yahoo News is the same where it's just like, this is not very substantial journalism. This isn't substantial storytelling. This is just either some facts or maybe some non-facts in the case of LLMs on a page that somebody got me to click on. And the somebody that got me to click on is most likely another algorithm, right? So I think what we have, the only danger that I see is not for journalists doing their job. It's for people being able to discern real content versus not real content, particularly if we start to branch off into misinformation or disinformation, where people are trying to politically influence voters, let's say, or to get people to buy into a fraud or things like this. And I think that that's, it won't affect journalists as much as it will affect people's ability to make a decision on reality.
I think, from my very unexpert opinion, there's a really cool opportunity to empower individual journalists, but also sort of erode the infrastructure that we have for a lot of these large news corporations. I think inherently with all these models out there, people are going to distrust mainstream media less because they're inundated with so much information. Because there's essentially this deluge of content that's coming at them. And I would hope that this is an awesome opportunity for individual trust, like individual people that consumers trust to have their own platforms to tell the stories they want and to have them funded through Substack or newsletters or whatever it might be. I personally think that that would be a very good thing for journalism because you could follow the things that you're interested in from the people that you trust. On the other hand, that might make things inherently even more divisive if you're getting news from individual sources who have individual biases and that aren't overseen by more infrastructure. I don't know if that's necessarily true, but it could be true. It's like, hey, I only go to these three news sources. That's the only places I trust. Then that inherently means that all the other things I'm not listening to. So I have no clue how this is going to turn out, but I'm pretty interested. It seems like this is grounds for a possible revolution of sort of how news used to be, where, oh, I really trust these places to give me the best news. And I don't think that there's anything more trustworthy than individual people. I mean, it seems like we've kind of lost a lot of trust in more mainstream news organizations anyway. So I don't know if I'm optimistic or pessimistic, but I'm interested, inherently interested to see how this develops.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of exciting. And I think it's been really cool to watch the revival of like newsletters and podcasts and things like this, because I think that it was a little bit of pulling away, A, from mainstream sources, but also B, from the push towards algorithmically driven content, and particularly the push towards the top 10 results on Google, right? I think like a lot of times people in the past few years have really been looking for what voices do I connect to? Well, who do I want to learn from? Who do I trust? And I agree with you that it's kind of moving more towards independent voices or individual voices. And I think that that can't hurt in the long run. I mean, in the long run, also from a journalism perspective, we want myriad voices, and maybe even we want, you know, the ability for journalists to go out on their own to do long-term investigations, which unfortunately a lot of newsrooms are not investing in anymore because they take time, they take money, they take a whole team, and it's just not valuable enough. It doesn't produce enough value for the papers anymore to really invest in that the same way that they used to. And so one way that that could change is, as your prediction is, kind of that enough people want to fund these investigations that they can go on independently of a traditional news org.
I think that model is hopefully really good for what I would describe as true journalism. Just as you said, if I'm not being funded from a commercial perspective, I'm being funded from individuals who are paying a subscription for my work. That is difficult now for a corporation or one of these news entities to operate just on subscriptions. But individuals, the amount of money you can make, it matches a lot better with your cost of living than it does with running a business. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is something that could work locally with a lot of individual authors or journalists that breaks down at a larger news entity scale. I mean, you look at, for example, Vice, which is essentially going under right now. Yeah. I think historically they were looked at as sort of that thing where they did these thought pieces, they went down these rabbit holes. But that model is essentially failing them, which is kind of sad because, I mean, you can say about what you want about their journalism, but I think that they really did make articles based on curiosity more so than commercial commercial benefit. And unfortunately, commercial benefit at scale loses out. But locally, I don't think it necessarily does.
Well, yeah, I mean, just even my time working at USA Today, which owns Gannett, and Gannett ended up buying quite a bit of the local papers and consolidating them, which fundamentally changed the way local newsrooms operated across the United States. And you really saw a generalization of how those papers worked, whereas maybe before they were quite myriad and they were very different in the way the newsrooms worked and the way the editors chose stories, and therefore they were more diverse. It became more general, vanilla, same way everywhere, because it essentially wanted to create a cookie cutter across the entire U.S. And one thing I like your idea of like going back to journalism's origins, because, you know, journalism used to be, you know, it's a group of four of us and we got access to a printing press and we're going to post our opinion as, you know, this political group, or we're going to post our opinion as, you know, believers in this thing. And it was definitely not, you know, it was definitely biased reporting. But I think the idea of full journalistic neutrality is something that even we're asked to question when we're in journalism school, when you go through the training, because what person can be 100% neutral when looking? It's just not possible. And that's even, you know, going back to my thesis, that's even what it showed. You know, it showed that the types of stories that somebody that could speak Arabic on their own were writing were fundamentally different than the folks who were using translators. I mean, we just can't, you know, we're humans. We can't communicate and talk and tell stories exactly in a 100% neutral way. And I think, this might be an era where people embrace that and decide to say, I'm starting a new publication. It's 10 of us. And this is going to be, you know, what we report about. And we have this funding. And if you want to support our work, yada, yada, yada.
I think that there's a very strange parallel between this and, for example, the models that we build in data science. So if we build one very big model that is semi-generalizable to a lot of different scenarios, it's probably never going to be as good as a bunch of individual models for specific use cases. Mm-hmm. Those individual models might overfit a little bit, whereas the large model is probably going to overgeneralize. And I think depending on the use case, depending who you are, it might be more practical to have some of these smaller models that overfit because they might be more useful to you based on your decision making than this one general model that's like, oh, well, 90% of people aren't going to buy this product. We're just going to assume everyone's not going to buy the product and we have a 90% accuracy. So I think that maybe for someone who doesn't understand journalism, but loves data, that analogy.
Yeah, I mean, it's even the idea that we do fine tuning, right? And the whole idea of fine tuning is you take something that's generally purposeful, or even transfer learning. If you do that, you take something that's generally purposeful or that's purposeful for one task, and you try to make it better for your specific task or your specific use case. I mean, we do that all the time, and I think that we're going to be doing it more with LLMs and GPT for all and stuff like this. I'm not sure how much folks have played with the open source do-it-yourself language modeling, but I think it could end up being a super powerful tool for you to say, I'm actually going to specialize this LLM with my data. I'm going to train it myself. I'm going to own the model, or I'm going to fine-tune it, right? Or I'm going to build my own reinforcement learning with human feedback layer, whatever it is. And I'm going to have something that really can talk like me, or that can talk about subjects that I like, or can talk like authors that I like. And I think it's a really powerful thing to be able to think of what does the individualization of machine learning look like in our future, which I feel like right now is going through a very special turning point.
Well, that's something I'm exploring right now. So I have one of the most unique data sets in the sense that through all of my YouTube career, I've responded to almost every comment that I've gotten. We're talking thousands of comments. So I have the perfect data set for RLHF.
Amazing.
So in some sense, I should be able to train a model based on my responses to a lot of questions. A lot of them are like, yes, thanks for watching, stuff like that. But at the same time, there's a lot that have reasonable content where people are asking me questions and I'm giving them legitimate feedback from my experiences. I also have all the video scripts and all the content, Medium posts, LinkedIn posts, tweets that I've written. Not as good for RLHF, but I'm interested to see what I can build with that. In the near future, because maybe I can just obsolete myself and then I'm just cruise off into the sunset.
So everybody heard it here first. When you become an AI podcast, then everybody will know.
That would be a very interesting one if I interviewed the AI version of myself.
Yeah.
For a podcast. I will put that down in the notes. That'll be a good one.
I hope you can trick your AI self.
Oh my goodness. I'm sure it would hallucinate and say terrible things, but that'd probably be worth it. So let's switch gears a little bit. I want to focus a bit more on data privacy. This is obviously a huge part of your life. What is data privacy and how did you get interested in it?
Well, I think we can connect it directly to what we're talking about. You know, you have data that you wrote. You have a purpose that you want to use for it. It should be that you own your data, that you're able to choose how your data is used, that you're able to also, you know, monetize your data if you want to, or all of the different things that you want to do should be essentially within your control. And so when we think about data privacy, we think about the idea of an individual being able to consent to what level of information they want to give to a person, to a service, to a system, and what they're getting in return for that, right? And so this is these contractual relationships and these consensual relationships that we really should have with our data and where it goes and how it's stored and who's using it and for what. And that's essentially the root core of the idea of data privacy and why it's so connected to human rights, especially in concepts like GDPR or the Brazilian law, LGPD. It's a basis in human rights because humans have rights to the data that they produce. And so I think the whole movement now to individualize your own models or to personalize your own models is a really good example of people saying, you know what? Why should OpenAI have all the fun with my data? I want to use my data and I want to build my own models for myself. And I think that's a really, you know, strong example of, you know, real data ownership and real consent and real ability to kind of be use your own data for powerful things that you want to do.
Amazing. So what is the current state of data privacy? I would imagine it's a little bit, I guess, lumpy in some sense.
So data privacy is essentially getting quite a bit of attention. I'm not sure if you heard the $1.3 billion fine that Facebook got handed down from the Irish data protection authorities this week. But I think it's a growing regulatory concern. I think there's a growing financial cost for not paying attention to things like data privacy. But then it's also, I think, a thing that's starting to become in the zeitgeist of things. I mean, I think a lot of the concerns that people have now around interacting with machine learning systems or even just computing and large data systems is this is creepy and I don't know why. It's, you know, I don't know how it's using my data. I don't know why it's using my data. And it makes me feel uncomfortable. And so this is what we see a lot of people of being like, everything's listening to me or I can't escape. Or even the complete opposite is I've given up. There's no such thing as privacy, right? But all of these different viewpoints are the same human emotion, which is I don't have control over any of this. And it doesn't, obviously, losing control, especially of your personhood, which is, you know, some semblance of your data, is not a great feeling for anyone. So I think in even just a cultural sense, that data privacy is also having a moment, which is probably why it's having a moment in regulation as well.
So how is it being viewed in regulation by different countries? I know different countries really have different perspectives on what data privacy is. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, most of the countries in Europe are very conservative with data privacy. The US is sort of a middle ground, and then countries in Asia are generally, and this is mass generalization, I don't want to offend anyone, but countries in Asia are a little bit more, believe less in individual privacy and their rights there. Is there legislation that varies by country or by continent, or is this something that is a little bit more uniform than I'm describing?
It's definitely country by country. Of course, in the EU, we have the GDPR, which covers the entire EU, which is, of course, the 27 plus two member states, right? I think get covered under GDPR. But we also see, so like Brazil has an extremely strong privacy law called LGPD, and Chile is now writing one as well. That's fairly strong. China last year came out with PIPL, which is a fairly strong, at least when you read it on paper, law about privacy in China. And that's particularly protecting Chinese data from leaving China. So it's also, when we think about these laws, and that was also some of the stuff that came down with Meta this week, and some things that are being proposed also in India, sometimes it's about data sovereignty. And it's about saying the data of the citizens of this country will not leave this country. And I think it's really interesting to see how this is playing out, because it's kind of playing out in all sorts of political zones, like right, left. This doesn't divide neatly on party lines. In fact, it starts to actually make a very varied picture of who cares about privacy, why do they care about privacy from a regulatory aspect. And in the US, it's heating up too. So California, you know, with CCPA, made some inroads, but when CPRA passed and it'll go into effect in September, it's really going to completely change the way US privacy works, because it's the first time that there's an agency dedicated to privacy in the US. And it'll be only for the state of California. But, you know, California tends to lead in these regulations anyways, like they did with some of the stuff around the automobile industry and so forth. And so I think it should be quite interesting to see like how it plays out. I know that the federal government in the US has also been talking about a federal law. I have no idea if that'll happen, but I think it's really a changeable landscape, even from a year-to-year basis right now.
So in maybe more layman's terms, can you describe just a little bit about what that legislation, for example, in the EU means for privacy of the individuals and like data sovereignty, and then maybe a little bit about what is happening in California and what the implications are? Just high level.
Yeah. Again, I'm not a lawyer. I'm a data person. So talk to a lawyer if you have questions. Just tell that for people. But GDPR gives essentially 8 fundamental data rights, or maybe it's 7 if we count out exactly ones. But it's based on the idea of human rights. And so it's based on the idea of you should be able to know what data is collected about you. You should be able to say no to processing of your data. You should be able to even say no on a use case level. So you say like, oh, it's cool to use my data for these things, but I'd really rather not contribute to military research or something like this. So essentially, these are different rights. You should be able to have an explanation if an algorithmic system makes a judgment based on your data. You should be able to delete it. You should be able to move it. So one of the coolest ones is data portability. So I could take my data from your service and I should be able to take it over and just upload it to a new service and I haven't lost anything. So this is really important for people like content creators and social networks and so forth. And so that's the theory of the law. Of course, how it's implemented, we've seen, you know, cookie banners. It's like, this is not at all what was intended in the law, you know? And so that's why I think we're at 5 years, actually this week, of GDPR. We're starting to see a deeper thinking ways of looking at the impact of GDPR. We're starting to see rulings that are much more impacting the way that we think about how we ask for consent, how we ask and communicate, how data will be stored, how data will be transferred. And I think if you're a data scientist and you want to have a long career in this space, I think it's, of course, I have a biased opinion, but I think it's reasonable to start thinking about how do I actually think about the user's data that I'm processing, and would they agree to having their data processed this way? And even if they would agree, you know, at what point in time am I going to ask them again? Because consent expires. So if you agree now, and then I'm still processing that same data you agreed on 10 years later, that's not really seen as a valid way to do things. And so it's interesting, because when you start thinking about it as a human, it makes sense. But as a data scientist, it's like, oh no, what are we going to do when we don't have any more data? And I think hopefully there's like a middle ground there. The California law, you can think of it as much, much, much more lenient than GDPR, but it does allow people to opt out. And it especially allows people to opt out of third-party sharing. So if you collect my data and I give you consent and I say, it's cool if you process my data, it's going to become a lot more difficult for you to take that data and sell it to somebody else or to share it with somebody else. Those are the things that are going to become a lot more complicated in California.
Interesting. Well, it seems like companies or some companies care a little bit more about this than others. I mean, I think Apple, they obviously operate globally and they're like, well, if we're doing it here, we might as well do some other stuff here. Or at least, you know, they let you opt out of app sharing and those things like that. I'm not saying that they're a best case study or benchmark, but it's something that I've seen and experienced when I use a phone. I'm interested, can we do a little case study, for example, maybe of what's going on with TikTok and data privacy to have some concreteness in understanding the domain a little bit better? Because that's something obviously front of mind for a lot of people. Should we ban it? Is our data in danger of going to China and being used in crazy ways? Do you have any kind of context on that? And would you be able to maybe describe it in data privacy terms?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that TikTok, just to be fair, has their own privacy engineering team as well. So I can't speak specifically to what privacy technologies they use or have deployed, but I do know, for example, that there's a privacy conference happening actually this week in Brussels, and that some of the privacy team of TikTok is presenting there about privacy engineering controls that they have put on their servers and systems. But I think that it's really interesting to me from where I sit now in Europe. Meta, Facebook, just got fined 1.3 billion euros for moving European data to US servers because it's been proven via the Snowden links and so forth that the NSA can snoop on that data. And therefore, that is a violation of the European residents' rights to have the NSA get access to their data. So let's just put that out there. It's like, this is a real thing that European courts are concerned with, that they're starting to issue huge fines on. And then it's very interesting to watch that same conversation start to happen in the US around TikTok and say, well, if all of this data is going to Chinese servers, then the Chinese government probably can get access to them and can probably do data mining on them if they were interested and can probably take a look at them. And then it's a bit funny because in the US, the NSA is already able to do that for US data. So it's like, okay, it's cool if my government does it, but if another government does it, it's definitely not cool. And so, I mean, it's a little bit of this, a little bit of this of who's doing it and what are the intentions. And it's a lot less about actual privacy, which is like, maybe nobody should be able to do that. If we had real end-to-end encryption, if we had real privacy controls, then we wouldn't be arguing which government gets to surveil us. We would instead be like, maybe nobody should surveil us. And maybe if we want to be surveilled, we should opt in rather than have to try to figure out how to opt out. And I think that's the funny thing from a data privacy perspective is like neither of those are really good fundamental arguments, but there are real technologies that we can use, for example, end-to-end encryption. There are other technologies that we can use from a privacy aspect where we can actually provide users with services where they can perhaps have reasonable or plausible deniability or doubt of their own actions. And to on a more serious note, when we look at maybe somebody that would be persecuted in China for the types of things they post on TikTok, or somebody who would be prosecuted in the US based off of what they Google map search or something like this, right? We get it on the serious side of this is why privacy is actually important, is that at the end of the day, people interact with systems without understanding the full risks and implications of searching a particular thing, of posting a particular thing. And we can say all day, oh, it's their fault. They should have known better and all these things. But we know as technologists, it kind of obfuscates when you interact with the screen. You don't really always understand the context that you're operating in. And I think as data people and as responsible data scientists, this can be something that we take on and we actually think through for the user. Hey, how do we communicate to them what context they're operating in? How do we communicate to them risk? Or how do we just protect everyone, right? And make sure that they're protected against even sometimes their own actions.
Data privacy seems like such a large domain with so many intricacies. Can you tell me about the book and how you approach explaining data privacy, talking about the use cases and how to learn this domain? Because to me, that's something that is a very large, almost insurmountable task. And I'm very fascinated with how you've described this.
Yeah. So, I mean, data privacy has a lot of aspects. It's social, it's cultural, it's historical, it's also legal, and it's technical. And in the book, Practical Data Privacy, that I wrote, I focused on the technical aspects of privacy. And I just said, you know, there's all this other stuff. You can read a lot about it. You can learn about it. But we're just going to focus only on technical privacy. And that means technical definitions of privacy. And it also means how do we technically implement private by design systems. And the reason why practical is in the title is because I wanted to take it away from just being theoretical. And I wanted people to actually get into coding privacy into things like machine learning systems, data engineering systems, and even data science systems. And I wanted people to learn some theory, play around with some of the different modeling or math that goes along with that theory, and then be able to close that chapter and close the book ultimately with actual open source libraries they can use, they can start experimenting with tomorrow, and they can take away. And I think the main point for me of the book is how do we get people who are privacy curious over the, you know, learning curve of entering into the technical field of privacy and into actually experimenting and doing. And thankfully, the technology itself has really come into its own in the past 5 to 10 years. And so now it is quite possible to build better, more private, more secure, and more secret systems using technology. The book is basically just a taster.
So I want to get into who does data privacy and also how people can get into data privacy, but a thought came into my head. I'm interested in how you think, for example, OpenAI is approaching data privacy with ChatGPT. That might be a loaded question, but and you can refuse to answer if you'd like. But to me, I'm really interested. Like, that is front of mind is, oh, I'm putting information into this system. What does it mean? Where is it going? And I think that's something almost everyone can relate to right now.
Yeah, yeah. And so I wrote two newsletters about this so far, about OpenAI and ChatGPT and privacy. So they had a huge privacy leak. I'm not sure how many folks experienced it or knew it, but there was about a day where people were being shown other people's chat histories. Which is, of course, quite, depending on the chat, could be quite difficult. And this was when Italy actually banned ChatGPT. So Italy banned ChatGPT when this leak happened, because OpenAI directly said the data that was exposed includes credit card numbers, names, email addresses, you know, real addresses, so on and so forth. And so OpenAI is readily aware that people are putting private information into ChatGPT and probably doing so sometimes knowingly, sometimes not knowingly. Sometimes just copy entire document, paste into ChatGPT and say, please summarize for me. But what OpenAI wasn't doing at the time is the ability to opt out of that going directly into the reinforcement learning system. Right. So those chats were basically probably, we don't know for sure, but probably being used for what happened with GPT-4 and perhaps what will happen with future iterations of even the RLHF layer. And so the one thing that they did to comply, so they had 30 days to comply and Italy turned them off. And the rest of Europe started looking, are we going to turn them off or not based off of how they respond? Now, when they responded, and this is largely a response, I think, that came from Microsoft, and Microsoft knows how to deal with regulatory concerns. They said, okay, we're going to give people the ability to opt out. We're going to also give people the ability to deploy their own model in Europe. And we're going to give people the ability to fine tune and own and deploy their own model in Europe. And I think that that's just the beginning of dealing with the privacy concerns. But it was pretty clear to me that OpenAI themselves probably didn't think through much, but that the Microsoft, who has invested a bunch of time and resources into building out GDPR compliance systems, has actually started now probably taking the reins a bit more in, let's think this through. Let's not just build and deploy and retrain and build and deploy and retrain without thinking about where the data is coming from. And potentially that will help make it more private by design in the future. But it's very hard to retrofit these things. And I have to just say, I've already filed a deletion request for my data to be deleted from all GPT models that are owned by OpenAI. And I have yet to receive a confirmation. So should be an interesting and exciting thing to follow. Should you want, you can sign up for my newsletter and see how it goes.
I'll leave the links to that and the specific newsletters in the description of this video. I feel like that's a cool way for anyone to learn more and sort of tune into the saga that you have going on. That was way more than I could have asked for. Excellent description. That definitely news to me, not things that I was conscious of. So let's say someone wanted to go into data privacy. Well, first, who is doing data privacy, for example, at a company like OpenAI? Who should be doing data privacy? And how can someone get into this domain?
So, I mean, most of these companies, and probably your organization as well, has a legal department and maybe even a privacy team and maybe even a data governance council or data governance team. And all of those people have some sort of responsibility for data privacy. But the growing part of the field that I'm really excited about is called privacy engineering. And this is a term that's kind of been around for about 10, 15 years, but is growing. You know, you can see the growth of it. And this is really people that bridge the technical divide. They can go implement things, they can build things, they can experiment and learn. And they often now have also data science experience or machine learning experience or data processing experience, data engineering, I guess. And they can kind of take things that the privacy team is prioritizing. They can take things that the governance team is prioritizing, and they can actually make them implemented into real data systems. And I think that that's the most exciting part of the privacy field right now, in the way that it's growing. And privacy professionals, even on the legal side and so forth, those are growing as well. So the IAPP did their annual privacy survey of privacy professionals and their salaries, and they found that they're growing year over year and starting to grow even more. This is mainly people on the legal side or people on the organizational side of privacy, but I think folks are starting to invest a bit more because the regulatory space is so complex and becoming more complex every year.
Amazing. And so how can someone, for example, obviously reading your book would probably help someone get into this domain, but what are some of the other ways they can find positions or set themselves up for success in landing a maybe even like a privacy engineer role?
Yeah, I mean, I think privacy engineering spans quite a bit of technology. So in the book, I go through a bunch of them. One is differential privacy. Another is federated learning. Another is encrypted computation. And then there's ways to join those together. Some of it could even just be data engineering with consent flows, right? Each of these could be their own individual specialization that you work on as a privacy engineer. So not dissimilar to learning data science, you kind of probably want to get a taster for everything, which of course the book is a great resource for, and then decide, you know, what's most exciting to me? Cryptography. I'm going to focus just on encrypted computation. Or, oh, actually federated learning is super interesting. I want to focus on this. And my recommendation, if you're getting started, is to find the one you're passionate about. You can always switch later, but find the one you're passionate about. Use my book if you want as an intro to all, and then decide, okay, I really want to focus on this. How do I get started more? Start your own project working on it. Start coding in it. Start with the open source libraries that are in the book, and then upskill yourself to where you're at the point where you say, I want to apply for a privacy engineer position. And I'm seeing more and more finally today, I think it was, I saw a post on like how to do well at your privacy engineering interview. So like there's starting to be even content around how do you coach yourself? What questions can you expect? What do you think that you want to specialize in within the field? And so I think it's a great time to join it, because if you join it now, you're going to have been one of the early joiners.
Amazing, Catherine. This was so enlightening in terms of, especially for me, learning about data privacy, learning about what's going on in the domain. Those are all the questions I had. I'm going to link your book and your newsletter in the description below. How can people learn more? How can people connect with you if perhaps they have questions? You can also say, I don't want anyone to reach out to me. That's totally fair game too. But and if you have any final words of wisdom, please, the floor is yours.
Yeah. So on my newsletter, I also have ways to contact me. So I have an email. I also have a PO box, because if you want to go really fully private, you can send me a letter. So I will write back. I promise. I've already gotten 3 letters. I'm writing back. And so you can write me in any myriad of ways. And I'm also, of course, on social media and so forth. You can find me there. And in terms of words of wisdom, I just want to say that, like, you know, I think if you're a data scientist and all of this sounds interesting to you, I can tell you that the math and the technical subjects involved in technical privacy are just as interesting, if not more so, than basic machine learning and basic data science. And so if that's a motivational thing for you and math is one of the reasons that you got excited about data science, then I can strongly encourage you to take a look at privacy and privacy engineering.
Amazing. This is so great. Thank you so much, Catherine.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of Ken's Nearest Neighbors. Many of you have been asking about how you can support the show, and we're extremely grateful for all the engagement so far. The best way that you can show your support is to subscribe to both the Ken's Nearest Neighbors and the Ken's Nearest Neighbors Clips YouTube channels. If you're listening to us on Spotify or Apple Music, giving us a rating and sharing any of the episodes with someone that you believe might find the content useful is also greatly appreciated. The Ken's Nearest Neighbors podcast is hosted by me, Ken G, produced by Bobby Hicks, and is edited by Mario Paul and Tony Pelleriti.